Welcome to Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero, in for Rose Aguilar. It is challenging to be a journalist right now. What is fair coverage in an era of good versus evil or right versus wrong? Is objectivity the same as neutrality? Are either of them or both of them the priority? Is being pro-democracy too biased for professionals? That is coming up in the second half of today's show. Right now, we're going to Texas to see how the Trump administration's rounding up of immigrants is playing out. Tuesday, we talked about the realities on the ground here in the Bay Area and about the history and effectiveness of sanctuary cities. You can find that with all our podcasts at yourcallradio.org. In this second episode, well, Texas is a whole nother story. There are no sanctuary cities there. They are literally against the law, regardless what the local authorities might want. Republican Governor Greg Abbott is a full-throated supporter of the Trump administration raids and echoes much of the same rhetoric about illegal aliens. Texas is even building its own walls on the southern border. The state's southern demarcation makes up nearly half of the U.S.-Mexico border, and it's home to the second largest population of undocumented immigrants, second to California. Pew Research says over 11 million undocumented immigrants live in the U.S. An estimated 1.6 million of them are in Texas. The Abbott campaign promised harsh immigration policies, and his administration has been only emboldened with the return of Donald Trump to the White House. Trump is doubling down on raids by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He's suspending entry to all undocumented immigrants and asylum seekers. Yesterday, he announced an order to the Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security to set up Guantanamo as a detention center for up to 30,000 migrants. It's important to note that among the targeted are employed taxpayers, refugees from violence, persecution, or natural disasters, and families of children born in the U.S. In Texas, there are no state protections for these vulnerable populations, but there are immigration advocacy organizations on full alert. They are stepping up with essential legal and social services for the local folks, even as they advocate for legal protections nationwide. Raíces is the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in Texas, founded in 1986. It is the state's largest provider of immigration legal services, opening over 10,000 cases each year. Without these essential services and access to trauma-informed care for most of their clients, those, including children, would have to go to court without representation. The agency works in and out of the courtroom to make strong cases for its client. Raíces is at the forefront of the ground battling the raids and any accompanying breaches of human rights. It also advocates nationally for immigration reform, particularly under the Trump administration. Its mission statement, to defend the rights of immigrant, refugee, and asylum-seeking people and families, empower communities, and advocate for liberty and justice. On the line, we have Chief External Affairs Officer Faisal Al-Jabouri. Faisal, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. Thank you. Tell us about what your organization faces on an average day now. How many people are coming to you? What do they most need?
Yeah, so I think one of the key things that's happening in Texas and also sort of nationally that we're seeing is a culture of fear that has been incubated. And right now, we've been hearing a lot about the workplace raids. We've been hearing a lot about these executive orders that have come down from the Trump administration. But we're also in real time trying to assess what are the practical implications on these legal and human rights? Mm-hmm. And how far is this administration going to go to abdicate its responsibility, you know, both to federal and to international law? Because right now, what you so sort of shrewdly pointed out is that we're not talking about a monolithic sort of immigrant identity, and we're not talking about a certain targeted population by the Trump administration. What we're looking at is even these historically well-regarded programs, including the Refugee Resettlement Program, the National Refugee Resettlement Program, that has been targeted by this administration. And so these, it's not going after criminals. It is going after mothers, fathers, children, families, and it is ripping out sort of the infrastructure that we've had in place as a nation to provide basic sort of support for populations that we've long embraced on a bipartisan level in this nation.
Tell me about a particular story, a particular case that emphasizes for us what folks are facing down there every day. Talk about a person who has come to races and received some help in court.
For sure. So, and what I think the other thing that's important for us to know is that we've long sort of seen sort of political attacks on immigration, and that goes under both, Democrat and Republican scenarios. But what we're looking at here specifically as well is the importance of language when we're talking about immigration, about the importance of not dehumanizing our community members. And I think that's, especially true in this longer conversation that you're having today, looking at what the media's responsibility is and how to responsibly report on immigration in the U.S. in 2025. Because what we're looking at here and what we're looking at from asylum seekers here is that, for instance, I can bring to mind two side by side scenarios within our asylum access services that our attorneys, work tirelessly to support both young mothers, Guatemalan mothers who were fleeing their home country, and I'm thinking about this one young woman with a 6-year-old child. Who left us a voicemail on our hotline at a particularly acute moment when she had not passed her asylum interview, of which these standards have continued to, sort of be raised, over the years and over the last several months, both of the Biden administration and going into this administration. And really, bottom line, she just said, she was in tears, saying, "I just need help. I just need help. My child and I just need help." Mm-hmm. And she had really seconds at that point, minutes to be able to get some type of legal support so that when her case came in front of an immigration judge on appeal about the her negative determination for her fear interview, that she had some qualified support there for her. And so our attorneys got the message. It was late on a Friday. They had to track her down because before there would be something akin to like caller ID, so that you could be able to trace back which facility someone was calling from. That was not the case at this point. And so had to track down the facility before close of business on a Friday to be able to then get special permission to speak to this young woman and to be able to do an initial consultation, like to find out that her court date was scheduled for first thing in the morning, the next morning on a Saturday morning. We were able to go in, we were able to represent her effectively, be able to essentially just say, look, bottom line, she was actually an indigenous language speaker, not a Spanish language speaker. And her asylum interview had been done in Spanish. And one of the rights that we afford immigrants in this nation is language access, right? So that your case can be properly adjudicated. I would want that. I think you would want that. I think we'd all want our primary language. And it's been promised. And so that was, we were able to ensure that she could be released and that her case for asylum could continue to be pursued, but that she was outside of federal government custody, reunited with family in the U.S., that her six-year-old daughter no longer had to be in essentially a prison, because when we talk about immigration detention, what we're talking about at that point is really facilities that are predominantly run by private prison contractors, right? And where the conditions sometimes are even worse than what one has come to expect from a traditional prison, and where there are continuously abuses that we have seen physical, mental, emotional, behavioral health, and where children have been forced to stay far longer than what sort of, again, the letter of the law sort of is meant to protect them from being in custody for an extensive period of time.
There's so much to unpack there. I want to pull out some of the threads of what you've been talking about. One of those is, you don't hear often about the trauma being inflicted on people. There's so much covering the legality, the illegality, the policies, the changes in policies. But for each individual, this is a traumatic situation. And what we're seeing here is the policies just making that worse. I'm curious what you're seeing inside the established systems, the legal systems and otherwise, that are addressing these people with some kind of compassion. Is there consideration, or is that just getting lost in the sheer crush of bodies?
I mean, I think it is. I think that's a fantastic way to put it, is that it is getting lost many times. But that's why it's so important to have advocates for individuals who are going through our U.S. immigration system. And I think that is, at the end of the day, why we center legal services, is because you as a family are about 10 times more likely to have some type of relief in the U.S. if you have the, if you have the support of a qualified attorney on your side. And as an individual, it's, anywhere from 2 to 5 times, depending upon the details of your case. But part of that also includes the importance of ensuring that they can be released out of detention as quickly as possible, because the majority actually do have ties here, right? Mm. They have ties. They have sponsors to be able to be with. It is the majority are not looking to sort of escape and disappear into the night, right? They've gone through a traumatic experience of migrating. That's the number one piece, because no matter what people think, is you do not uproot your life on a whim. Do not uproot your life and leave your country of origin unless the stakes have become so high that there is no other choice in your mind.
And that in many cases, you're willing to die for that. I mean, that's the obvious choice, is leave, with the possibility of dying along the way.
With the possibility of dying along the way, and that what the federal government has done, and also what the state government has done, has really leaned into these tactics that do not actually, when you're looking at long-term migration patterns, do not actually mitigate and make a difference there. You'll see sort of short-term or sort of changes in terms of rates of apprehensions at the border based upon, different policies being implemented. But at the end of the day, for, 30 years of tracking this deterrence approach to immigration in the U.S., and that includes things like state of Texas putting the buoys and razor wires in the Rio Grande, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that made national headlines, and those are being expanded upon right now. But all these deterrence policies at the border, these sort of quote unquote sort of enforcement, the militarization of the border, what they're doing is they're making the U.S.-Mexico border actually one of the most sort of dangerous areas on record, with the highest mortality rates. They're increasing the life-threatening circumstances that these individuals are going through. After they've already taken this life-threatening journey to get here to the U.S. and to actually not demand or feel entitled to or whatever, but actually to make good on the US's commitments to adjudicate equitably, you know, asylum cases. And that's what we're fighting for, right? Is that there is the equitable application of the law, and that the law is not sort of degraded and lost in this panic, in this frenzy, this national frenzy that we're that our elected officials are creating. And I think, you know, and I think the other piece is that we're putting so many resources into essentially attacking families versus going after a lot of the priorities that this nation's looking for, right? Like the Trump administration right now is diverting resources around from counterterrorism efforts in the US. They are diverting resources from efforts that are meant to stem drug trafficking in the US, because what are they doing? They're racial profiling across the nation and Texas and beyond, to be able to round up as many people as possible. And what we're saying is, like, racial profiling is because I'm sure you saw the news this week of the Puerto Rican family that was detained, right? And so it is about going after black and brown people, families who pose no threat to the U.S. and diverting resources away from actual national security.
I want to let our listeners know, if you're just joining us, that's Faisal Al-Jabouri. He's Chief External Affairs Officer for RAISES, the Refugee, can't talk today, the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in Texas. Now, he's going to be with us for just another 15, 20 minutes, where we're going to switch to a slightly different aspect of this conversation. So if you would like to talk to him, it's time to get on the phone lines now. The lines are open at 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. You can leave your question off the air or go on the air, whatever you prefer. And if you'd rather email us, yourcall@kalw.org. Again, that's the phone line, 866-798-8255, or email yourcall@kalw.org. I want to go back to what you were saying, Faisal, about humanity, about the picture of immigrants, documented or not, who are living in the U.S., working in the U.S. And there was a study by Brookings a few years ago, and the numbers suggest that a majority of undocumented immigrants here, they're living here, they contribute to the country, they build their lives within it for a decade or longer. That's the average. That message doesn't seem to penetrate, and part of the problem there is we've got a president who talks about evil people and bad guys, and he puts out really cartoonish imagery that's, you know, people are less inclined to parse because it's easy to glom onto. And I wonder if you're seeing that problem permeating the legal side of this. Do the judges at least seem to have a grasp? They might be looking at a law-abiding person who's just getting by. Or are you seeing in the courts there this assumption that you were just describing, that the deportations are taking in the right people who look wrong and they're uniformly a good thing? What are you seeing in the courts?
I think right now is that I think historically we've always also we've recognized that a lot of your luck, quote unquote luck, in this system is based upon the judge that you end up getting, right? And so the track records of judges really vary in Texas and nationally, whereas you do have those that are looking specifically at, again, you know, the letter of the law, and then you have those that are not inclined, regardless of the circumstances, to be granting any type of relief, in court, in immigration court. So again, your luck in the immigration system in the U.S. Depends wildly, or also about from the sort of the subjective sort of application of the law. I think right now, one of the key issues under this administration is that we're seeing, a lack of interest in even maintaining these lawful pathways to, you know, permanent status here in the US. And you see that by the attacks on humanitarian parole, on the attacks on temporary protected status, on the attacks on DACA, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the Trump administration that tried to nullify DACA in 2017 originally, and the attacks on DACA right now, it's remain and are hanging on by a thread, right? And so it is about those, it is about going after anyone and everyone. So the you can never speak to someone's intention, but it appears, and what this administration has been sort of saying in more or less words is that it actually doesn't even want these lawful pathways to immigration. It doesn't want to provide any type of relief. But you're right, when you're looking at the immigrant population writ large, when you're looking at even just specifically the undocumented population here in the US, the undocumented population pays nearly $100 billion in taxes, right? Mm-hmm. Like just shy of $100 billion in taxes. They pay into sort of systems that they will never benefit from at the end of the day, including, you know, Social Security, right? So, this administration and what President Trump has done since he began his political career, coming down that escalator in 2015, is to build his brand, his political brand, off of fear-mongering, off of building his own power by scapegoating an entire population and saying that, you know, using these tropes that have long been sort of employed historically, going back, you know, centuries even, to say, I'm gonna build my power, I'm gonna amass my power by denigrating and demonizing the other, mm-hmm. and he's done it successfully, really has, because we've seen the nation as a whole move much further to the right. We just saw the passage in Congress and signed into law yesterday, the Laken and Riley Act, where, again, speaking about humanizing, I think the devastating part about the Laken and Riley Act is that it actually uses and abuses this woman's name and legacy. In a way that is, you know, absolutely, in my opinion, sort of, you know, it's immoral, because it is a law that is designed to deny people due process. It is a law meant to say that if you are an undocumented child who steals a candy bar, and you're just accused of stealing a candy bar, mm-hmm. that you're prioritized to be detained and deported without any element of due process. And that is a bipartisan-backed, you know, piece of legislation that is now the law of the land.
Yeah, and there is an entire hour in itself, so we'll leave that lie while we take a break here. The phone lines are busy. Sandy in Oakland, Mary in San Francisco, will get right to you when we get to the other side of this break. This is Your Call. We're looking at the legal situation on the ground for immigrants who are in line to be deported, and we are talking to, we are talking to Faisal Al-Jabouri, Chief External Affairs Officer for AISES, the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in Texas. I'm Angie Cuero in for Rose today. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Call. If you've missed any portion of this conversation, keep an eye on our podcast page. You can find all our episodes there, and this one will go up right after we finish airing this hour. Phone lines are open. We'd like your contribution to our conversation at 866-798-8255. And Sandy in Oakland has taken advantage of that invitation. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. That the Arizona CBS station is reporting that at least 15 tribal members of the Navajo Nation were swept up by ICE in Phoenix, and that they were not allowed to use their cell phones, but they wanted proof that they were Navajo. So eventually one young girl, I'm reading from the press release, was allowed to use her cell phone and texted her family, and who sent her a photo of her certificate of degree of Indian blood, CDIB, and she was allowed to go. So that's now Homeland Security is sweeping up Native Americans too.
Thank you for that information. I can't say we're happy to hear it, but I'm glad to have the record on it. We'll look further into that story here, Sandy. Thank you so much. Did you want to make a comment on that, Faisal?
Again, I think this just points to these Trump policies being about racial profiling at the end of the day. So it is not about essentially even finding undocumented immigrants. It is about terrorizing Black and brown people here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Mary in San Francisco, thanks for waiting. You're on your call.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm Jewish American, granddaughter of immigrants. And I want to ask your guests about two deportations that happened during the first Trump administration that seemed particularly unfair to me. The first was a legal long-term permanent immigrant, a man, a veteran who'd served in Iraq. He had a family, business, but he was deported on a 30-year-old marijuana conviction because it's a felony. And then the other concerns, two young men in Arizona who were caught up in a sweep, but not an ICE raid. This was DEA. They were looking for marijuana farms. And these two men were shown to be undocumented, and they were deported to Mexico. NPR had to do the first interview from Tijuana with this long-term permanent resident. My question is, why isn't cannabis legalization, marijuana legalization on a federal level, having it no longer be a felony, seen as crucial and intersectional to real immigration reform? Thank you.
Thank you for that, Mary. I hadn't heard of those cases, Faisal, but obviously they're concerning.
For sure they're concerning. And I would just say, on this end, I'm unsure of the specific details of these cases myself. And so it would be something that we would have to look into to provide a more sort of thoughtful answer specifically on these cases in particular. I think, one of the key things is that you're looking at and you're having a conversation, you're broaching another sort of hour's worth, I think, of really worthy dialogue on also the intersection between immigration law and also, criminal justice reform, right? Mm-hmm. And I, again, bottom line is that who does the interpretation of the law, the benefits of changed law over time, like who does that benefit and who does not, right? Mm-hmm. And who's continuously penalized and who is not. And I think specifically under the Trump administration, what we've seen and under the first one and what we're beginning to see now is that, bottom line, to be an immigrant means to be unwanted in this nation.
Thank you for that. And I just want to go back to what we heard from Jane about, and I've looked up some news stories on that. While not confirming her exact report there, we do have from NBC News, American citizens, including citizens of native tribal nations, have been pulled into the vast immigration operations ordered by President Trump in accordance with his campaign vow to conduct mass deportations. Those who are getting caught in immigration and custom enforcement raids are being targeted because of their race or skin color, according to witnesses. The Navajo Nation office was flooded with calls from tribal members living off reservation, with many reporting being questioned about their identity. by ICE officers. Much more to that story. And we'll stay on top of that as we're doing a series of these conversations about the immigration raids here in America. Going back to Texas on this one, I know, Faisal, that one of the issues being faced by nonprofits who do the kind of work you do is that you're all overwhelmed right now, that so many people are being swept up. There's so much determination to get them out of the country, and they're even talking about getting Guantanamo ready to hold immigrants, that I wonder, how are you functioning in terms of being able to tend to your other work, you know, the national advocacy, that sort of thing? I'm assuming you're swamped.
It's a fair assumption. And I would say, just again, you speaking about the potential of detaining up to 30,000 on Guantanamo. Part of that also just speaks to the performance that is that is part and parcel of this immigration enforcement under this administration, because bottom line is that the American, the average American associates Guantanamo with terrorism, right? Based upon its use post 9/11, right? And so I think I would venture to guess, quite intentional to aid the narrative that this is about American safety, when really it's about tearing communities apart. And I think for us, one of the most important things is to resist getting overwhelmed by this sort of continued avalanche of action and information or disinformation coming out of this administration that is that can very easily distract and sort of diminish our efforts. Mm-hmm. And so specifically looking at it from an advocacy side, so much is that this is one of the first interviews that I'm doing right now, coming towards the end of his second week, because we want to see how these things play out, right? It doesn't do anyone any favors to continue to sort of to fan the flames and to not be fact-based in our approach. And so, it's really important for us to see sort of how do these sort of executive orders that were signed immediately, how do those play out, right? How do those, where are where are the wheels of justice going to be able to sort of keep some semblance of sort of normalcy in place? And where do we really need to be targeting our efforts? So for example, birthright citizenship and the attack on birthright citizenship from this administration. Thankfully, there's been an indefinite stay on enforcement of that executive order. Mm-hmm. And so we're like, okay, the justice system is holding right now and doing its job as this gets litigated in the courts. But where do we need to be shifting our efforts a little bit, more directly? Well, specifically, we started this conversation talking about the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program.
Right.
Whereas we knew that was likely going to be under attack based upon sort of the ways in which the first Trump administration sort of chipped away and degraded that program to sort of, a program that last year brought in over 130,000 people to be resettled in the U.S., which was the largest in 30 years. Whereas the last year of the Trump administration, it was less than 12,000 were resettled as part of that program. So we knew that they were going to attack that program. We didn't realize necessarily, some of the tactics they would use. And so at the end of, Rubio's first week as Secretary of State, that's when the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration decided to cut off all funding for the reception and placement program. That first step in bringing in people who have been waiting years, if not decades, and going through at least 10, you know, background checks. So if people who have been thoroughly vetted, promised to be, welcomed and provided sort of a pathway to put down roots here in the U.S., completely just cutting off that program, right?
And you know what? With that, I have to let you go, Faisal. We have our other guest in the wings here. But you've brought us so much information. I'm very grateful. I'm grateful for your work as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Faisal Al-Jabouri is the Chief External Affairs Officer for RICES. You can find them online, RAICESTexas.org, RAICESTexas.org. Now we move to an issue that I promise you journalists are at least pondering, if not struggling with, the ethics of reporting on immigration now and over the coming years of the Trump administration. Now, many immigration reporters saw the natures of their jobs already shifting during the first 4 years under Trump. Ethical considerations deepened around identity protection, legal jeopardy, and polarization-dominated media narratives. Most complex of all, what was formerly recognized as straightforward coverage was successfully painted by interest groups as biased. Journalists and their sources find themselves targeted by the current administration for all kinds of coverage. Micah Rosenberg is on the line. She's an investigative reporter on immigration for ProPublica. The awards she has won for her work offer exactly zero protection against government targeting. Micah, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Hi.
Thank you so much for having me. Hi.
I'm so glad to. I want to jump right into the deep end with what the job of a legit journalist is, because we've always heard they should be neutral and or objective. Jay Rosen is a prominent media critic from NYU, and he criticizes what he calls the view from nowhere and how the press can cling to that. And an example of that would be refusing to weigh in or state the facts on how big Trump's first inauguration crowd was, because that would be shown as bias. If you reported what we were all seeing, that would be bias. So I wonder if that consideration has crept into how to report on immigration.
Well, you know, I think it's a good question. And I think the role of journalists writ large and in immigration in particular is to do really the hard work to understand the nuance and complexity of the issues that they're covering, the laws, the history, you know, and explain them to the public and do that with the intention of, you know, exposing wrongdoing if power needs to be held to account. But especially when it comes to immigration, there's a lot of legal and regulatory weeds to sift through that can lend itself to misinformation because it's hard to understand. And then, of course, there's a real sort of personal aspect to it because this is something that deeply affects people's lives. You know, it forms their identities. So I think really having this base of knowledge helps you find stories, but it also helps you try to combat when administrations and, you know, this is true in both Republican and Democrat administrations are giving false or only partially true narratives about their policies. So I think that that's something to stick to and to think about going forward in the next 4 years.
We've got just a few minutes with Micah, by the way. So if you have questions or comments about media coverage of this topic, we'd very much like to work you into the conversation. Our number is 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255, and Micah is with ProPublica. Let's talk about putting stories in context, because you can hardly take a new development on immigration, on the rules coming out of the White House or what kind of enforcement is going on without, you know, you can't cover everything every time. You can't say, here's the history of the Trump administration on immigration. Here's where it's being challenged in the court. Here's this, here's that. But without that context, it's even more easy to dismiss it as non-news or as bias or as narrative. Tell me how you pick and how your editor works with what needs to be in those stories to give this its proper context without writing an encyclopedia.
That's a good question. And it's a lot of conversation. And I think it comes from what, you know, we were discussing before of kind of having a really sort of deep understanding of what you're writing about, never putting something on the page that you don't fully understand. And to do that, sometimes you have to, you know, stop, go back to sources, go back to the original documents, go back to all of the information that really provides the basis for what you're publishing. And, you know, I think sometimes people, you know, who read the news, especially from, you know, organizations that are really rigorous about fact checking and sort of how we pull news stories together, don't necessarily see all of that work that goes behind the word choices and, you know, the sentences that are put on the page. And sometimes they're written in a way that that will summarize a lot of the material, but that still is faithful to the facts. So I think it's a constant balance of sort of not trying to overwhelm the reader with something is too dense and that they don't understand, but also making sure that, you know, every word that you're choosing, every fact that you're putting in there has a real strong basis in you know, your reporting.
I want to look at two premises that I mentioned as I introduced you and see how they wash with you. For one thing, is it more difficult as a reporter right now to get hold of sources? Are the sources frightened? Are you frightened to go on record about things?
I think that, you know, I don't know yet, you know, if there'll be sort of, you know, how that those kinds of, you know, attacks could play out in the future. But I really think that sticking to this, you know, the basic tenets of journalism of having everything that you write, you know, backed up and thoroughly fact checked, and also having a sort of no surprises approach, which is something that, you know, we do where we're, you know, going to before we publish anything, we're sort of rigorously going to the people who it might mention and double checking that things are correct. So I think when that's the case, when you have what you're reporting is backed up, it is more difficult to attack it. And that's, you know, that's our hope that that kind of reporting will shine through, you know, as opposed to other kind of, you know, things that appear on social media or, you know, that don't have that kind of rigorous editorial process behind it. So, you know, I think definitely there is an element of, you know, some more sources may be fearful to talk. But I think in some cases when the topics are sensitive, that's always the case. And I think, you know, it's our job to sort of continue forth with those, so try and wade through those barriers and continue to do the kind of reporting that we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me what you feel. I mean, you've been on this beat for so long with immigration, and I'm wondering what in your eyes is being undercovered versus overcovered right now when it comes to immigration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually think there's a lot of great immigration reporting out there. And maybe the bigger problem is that sort of getting the public to pay attention or care sometimes mm-hmm. because of what you mentioned, that it's such a polarized issue that people might just gravitate to the types of stories that confirm their already sort of strongly held beliefs. But there's a lot of things that are going on that are written about. But, you know, one thing that I've been looking at, which I think is interesting and that maybe has been undercovered is recent, you know, border crossers who aren't from Latin America have been coming in larger numbers in recent years from a wider range of countries. And sometimes they can end up being sort of less visible in the United States. And so I'm trying to focus on different communities or populations that aren't necessarily sort of always in the spotlight is something that I think is interesting. And as far as what is sort of overcovered, you know, and I say this as someone who really loves using data in my reporting, is that, you know, sometimes I think there's an overemphasis on kind of the month-to-month statistics, you know, whatever they may be, the number of border crossers, the number of ICE arrests. And I think you really have to drill down more into those and and look at the historical context to understand what they mean, their significance of them, and so really explain to people, you know, what is happening beyond just the day-to-day ups and downs.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like there's the public outrage around the most controversial aspects of the Trump administration's policies. It isn't what it's been in the past. It's almost as though, and you can question the premise of my question if you will, but my impression is that there's a certain numbing among the news consumers. There's so much happening now. There's so much that happened before that what used to be an outrage is now a mild inconvenience. How do you, as a journalist, push through what might have become the overwhelm on the part of the news consumer?
I mean, I think that's just a problem generally of people kind of having news fatigue mm-hmm. in general. But, you know, I do there's a couple different aspects to that question. I do feel like that there has been, you know, a shift in public opinion around immigration in recent years that has to do a lot with kind of how immigration to the country has changed over time. And there's you know, an aspect of that that I think is playing into that. But I also think that there's an effort by this administration particularly to really sort of make a media spectacle out of some of their, you know, some of their immigration stance. Yes. And so I think that that could also contribute to the overwhelming feeling that it's an intentional strategy on the part of the administration to sort of put forward their view, you know, on television, on social media, of, you know, a kind of blitz of immigration enforcement, which, you know, may or may not reflect as time goes on kind of the realities on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I think lastly, you know, in the first Trump administration, I think there was a lot of policies that they did in sort of a hasty manner that might have led to a kind of a sloppy rollout, you know, thinking of the travel ban, which led to mass protests in the airports when people couldn't come in. You know, obviously family separation, which caused, you know, huge national outcry. And, you know, they were in office for 4 years. They had 4 years out of office to really sort of hone a lot of their policies. And I think that they're doing things in a targeted way, at least in these first, you know, few days and weeks, to maybe avoid those types of, you know, very obvious controversial situations right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about the changing landscape of news coverage, and we're seeing some real differences in for-profit news versus nonprofit news. The Washington Post, their motto was "Democracy dies in darkness," and then they went ahead and proved it by, you know, pulling presidential recommendations before the vote. And, you know, we saw Jim Acosta at CNN, who was doing quite well in the ratings, but was an enemy of Donald Trump. And all of a sudden, he's gone from CNN because his choice was to do that or be on the air at midnight. And I'd like to think that nonprofit agencies such as ProPublica are not only picking up some slack there, but might be a tiny bit more immune to that kind of political machinations. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, we would like to hope so. And I think we you know, I'm relatively new here, but my sense of the organization is that that's really what they aim to do. And I think that, you know, everyone here and, you know, also at a lot of other media outlets, you know, really believe in the power of, you know, as I mentioned, fact-checking, sort of the very rigorous editorial processes that all of our stories go through, you know, legal checking, and really basing your reporting on sources and documents that are cross-check on both sides of the debate. And, you know, I would hope that people would seek out that type of journalism that sticks to those principles. And I do think a lot of the outlets that have been attacked, you know, do stick to those. But I think that, as I said, sometimes it's hard to argue with if you really have, you know, the goods to back up what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Tell me if there's anything, as we get to the last few minutes of our conversation, tell me if there's anything you think it's urgent for the audience to know about what it's like on the immigration beat these days and what's going on behind the scenes that they should know about your reporting and your job.
Well, you know, I think for a lot of journalists right now, there's a sort of fire hose feeling of news. But, you know, but I think there's also a certain element that you know, and it's part of our job as journalists, that, you know, we need to remember that there's, you know, abuses of power and things to be uncovered and brought to the public eye in every administration. And there have been immigration policies that have harmed people that were put in place by both Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, I also think that's important to emphasize now, because Trump is going to try and take credit for a lot of actions that in some cases might be kind of regular order of business for the government. You know, illegal border crossings, for example, dropped in the final months of the Biden administration because of harsh asylum policy that he put in place. And also, you know, Obama currently holds the record even beyond Trump's first term for most deportations. So, you know, Trump has said that he wants to outdo them both. He's tried a lot of the policies that he's rolled out already before. Some of them were successful, some of them were not, or had mixed success, didn't have the money behind them to really, you know, do what he wanted. So I think we just need to remain vigilant to see how that plays out and sort of try and take a beat from, you know, the blitz that he wants everyone to be overwhelmed by and really look, take a sober look at it.
Thank you so much for your work, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Megha Rosenberg, she's an investigative reporter on immigration for ProPublica. If you've missed any portion of this conversation and to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can find us on iTunes. We would appreciate your giving us a review there. You can email your show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Nina Kissinger helped produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks for that special appearance by the fire alarm. I hope that wasn't too intrusive for you all. Thank you for joining us. I'm Angie Cairo, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's your call.